morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order, February 12th, 2020. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop. Senator Wilson is back, and we have a quorum. Today we have a presentation that we've had many times over the years. Our committee's being joined by Senator Olson. And we also have Senate President Giesel in the room. And we've asked Department of Revenue to come forward and remind the committee and show the public the order of operations of our revenue stream dealing with oil. And at a very high level, and again, this is a very high level interaction of how the funds flow into the Treasury. There's a lot of interrelationships that we're not going to go over today, but hopefully it'll give us a feel for the complexity in which we have to deal with in not only forecasting and assuming our revenue stream, but how it's interplayed within itself, and that all oil is not equal. They have different royalty, different severance tax issues, depending on geographical areas. So with that, I've asked the Department of Revenue to come up with a volunteer, and they volunteered their chief revenue economist, Mr. Stickel. If he can come forward, he is not new to the committee. I think he's going to take us through the presentation today, and he has some assistance with other folks from the department. And if we have a question for him, if he wants a lifeline or he wants his worker to help him, it's up to him. We'll just kind of let it flow. And we're being joined by Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's okay, I'd like to have Connor up here next to me. He's going to be my lifeline today.
Okay, if he can come forward. And before you get started, I just would like to remind the committee that when Mr. Stickel started doing these type of presentations, he looked as useful as his assistant sitting next to him. And now the roles have slowly changing as time has gone on. So we've been doing this for quite a few years, well over a decade. And Mr. Stickel's been very instrumental in putting together over the years the revenue source book, and has taken many suggestions from the committee and in assembling that book to help with the clarity. Go ahead, your presentation.
For the record, Dan Stickel, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, and I do have with me Connor Bell, who's one of our petroleum economists. Been doing a great job, and he actually did a lot of the modeling and analysis that went into this presentation. So he may be my lifeline if there's any of the technical questions there. So I think the plan is I will deliver the main presentation, and then at the end, if time allows, we do have an addendum with some additional information about share of state cash flows and some information the committee's requested, and Connor will deliver those slides. So our purpose here today is to give an overview of how the oil and gas production tax works, a high-level overview of the calculation, and then also to discuss the fiscal system more broadly, to look at other elements of taxes and royalties. We're not looking at any specific policy or proposal today. Our goal is to help build a understanding of the nuts and bolts of the current system and how it works.
Okay, so we have an hour and a half today because we have a joint session, so I'll watch the clock and the slides and adjust it, so we'll let it flow unless I'm forced to speed it up a bit.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I think that will work, and we'll take a pause at the end of the basic presentation before we jump into the addendum and see how time looks. So slide 2 is a list of some of the acronyms used in the presentation. I know the committee in the past has asked us to kind of spell out acronyms, and this is a list of some of the more common ones for the folks watching at home that might not be familiar with all of these different terms that we use. We'll do our best as we're going through to say the full term instead of use the acronym, but sometimes there is a lot of jargon in the production tax system and conversation. Slide three is an overview of the presentation. We'll start by looking at all of the sources of oil and gas revenue to the state, and then we'll move into a detailed walkthrough of the production tax in particular and each step in that calculation. The focus of the presentation is on the North Slope and North Slope oil in particular. The reason for that is this is the main revenue source to the state. There's lots of other carve-outs and smaller provisions for gas production, cook inlet. I would be happy to talk about those at a later date, but the focus today is on the North Slope oil tax. We'll walk through fiscal year 2021, which is the budget year in front of the legislature, and then at the end we will look at a five-year span of fiscal years 18 through 22. Slide four is just a disclaimer as we go through the presentation. So we've attempted to take a very complex tax system. I've heard experts say it's one of the top five most complicated in the world. And we're attempting to break it down into understandable pieces at a level that the folks watching at home can understand. So our presentation is based on aggregated data and our forecasted estimates of various items that fit into the production tax. And it's important to note also that we are economists, and so on down the road, please do not use anything that we say as an official tax or legal interpretation. So slide five, Alaska receives state revenue from oil and gas from four primary sources. There's a state royalty that's received for production from state land. We also receive a share of royalty for production on federal land. And then there's the corporate income tax, which is based on worldwide net income apportioned to Alaska for most corporations doing business in the state. There's a state property tax that applies to all property anywhere in this, all oil and gas property anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile offshore limit. And then there is a state production tax, also known as a severance tax. And so you'll see these two terms used interchangeably from time to time, production tax and severance tax. A severance tax is a tax that's levied on the taking of a resource, the severing of a resource. Our production tax is a form of severance tax that is levied by the state of Alaska. And you'll see with royalty in particular, and then the corporate property and production taxes that apply to property and activity on state land, not all oil is the same in how it's treated in the fiscal system, and we do have a slide at the very end of the presentation that gets into that concept in a little bit more detail. So slide six shows all the sources of state revenue from oil and gas for fiscal years 2018 through 2022. These include both the unrestricted general fund revenues as well as any restricted revenues that go to special funds. Note here that the property tax amount shown is the state share only. There's an additional about $450 million a year in property tax that does flow to the municipalities, primarily the North Slope Borough. We have the corporate income tax, which applies to C corporations in the state. We have the production tax, which will be the focus of most of the rest of the presentation. And then state royalties. On this slide, the state royalties numbers include bonuses, rents, and any share of royalties that flow to the permanent fund and school fund. There's settlements to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, and what these are is any settlements of assessments or disputes regarding minerals, taxes, and royalties are dedicated by Constitution to go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And then finally, we receive a small share of revenue from the National Petroleum Reserve. That's any production on the federal land west of the Colville River. Currently, this is a relatively small annual amount based on lease sales that have taken place. We do expect, as production from Grater's Moose's Tooth 2 and the Willow Field come online, that this NPRA shared revenue number will grow significantly in the future.
And before we go to the next slide, Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Thank you. So looking at this slide, I see royalties is by far the lion's share at this point, $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion, et cetera. And looking at the previous slide, it says royalties based on gross value of production. So just to confirm, royalties are paid when wells are producing. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, that's correct. The royalty number that we report here also includes a small amount of revenue from bonuses and rents, and those are paid, can be paid before production comes online. But the royalty on producing oil is the primary amount there.
So just a follow-up. So thank you. So aside from bonuses and rents, which you just stated was a relatively small number, wells need to be producing to be able to provide royalty income to the state, and non-producing wells, or wells that are being explored or idled or what have you, do those pay royalties to the state?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, the simple answer is no. So the producer would pay the bonus when they acquire the lease. There would be an ongoing rental for the lease. But then to pay the royalties, which is the more significant revenue, you're correct that production needs to be taking place.
We can continue.
So moving on to slide 7, this is a new slide we added this year, and it just shows at a real high level the overall order in which elements of the oil and gas fiscal system are applied. So royalties come first based on the land ownership, the owner, whether it's federal, state, or private. They get their share of oil right off the top of the calculation before any taxes are levied. Next comes property tax, and state and local property taxes are actually considered lease expenditures that can be applied against the production tax. And the production tax, which we'll be discussing in detail in the coming slides, that comes after royalties and allows production tax or property tax as one of the deductions. Corporate income tax is based on worldwide net income, is part of the tax base there. And the corporate income tax subtracts property and production taxes in its tax base. And then we have state corporate income tax coming before federal corporate income tax, because the state corporate income tax is considered an allowable deduction for the federal tax. Just to kind of keep this overall order of the fiscal system in mind, and this plays into some of the analysis of cash flows that we have later on in the addendum to the presentation. So now moving on to slide 8, this is kind of the meat and potatoes of the presentation we have here. There's a lot going on this slide, and we'll spend several slides walking through it piece by piece. What we've done here is taken the income statement as presented in the back of the revenue sources book, and that income statement walks through an illustration of the production tax calculation for fiscal year 2021, again going through each step of the production tax calculation. So we start on the top here with an average oil price of $59 per barrel. That's our forecast for fiscal 21, and forecasted daily production of 490,500 barrels a day. From those, we calculate the annual production and the dollar value of that production. And so our focus on over the next several slides will be on taking that total annual value of production of about $10.6 billion and looking at how that works through the tax calculation. A few notes, this is an aggregation of multiple companies. Each company has slightly different tax profile and economics. And this is, again, just for North Slope Oil, since that's the most significant contributor to the state treasury. So slide 9, walking through the income statement, we'll start here at the top. Step 1 is calculating the taxable barrels. Any royalty barrels are subtracted from the calculation before applying tax, regardless of who owns those barrels. Typical royalty rates are 1/8, which is 12.5%, or 1/6, which is 16.67%, but the rates do vary. Federal and private land royalty is also subtracted here. And we also subtract any barrels not subject to tax due to being in federal waters beyond the 3-mile limit. Currently, a portion of North Star production falls into this category. The Liberty Field would also fall into that category and not be subject to production tax. So from that calculation, we arrive at the total taxable barrels in the state for the year, which is forecasted 159 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.4 billion.
And if I'm reading this correctly, to ship the downstream, what you have is the downstream, that's $1.5 billion rounded off. That's to move the oil from pump station 1 down to Cherry Point or wherever the other sail point is south of Alaska after the tanker.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And the next slide discusses the netback costs in the downstream, and those shipping costs in particular. So if I may, looking at slide 10, this takes the moves from the taxable barrels to the calculation of gross value at point of production. This is a term that's used widely in the production tax and royalty calculations. You'll also hear the gross value point of production and wellhead value. Those terms are sometimes used interchangeably. They refer to a similar concept. And so to get from the taxable barrels to the gross value at point of production, you do subtract those transportation costs, also referred to as netback costs. Those are two other terms that you'll hear used somewhat interchangeably. So we start with the sales price at market. The ANS Alaska North Slope crude is valued at the west coast of the United States, Long Beach in particular. And we subtract any costs of moving the oil from the oil field where it's produced on the slope down to that market on the west coast. These include marine transportation costs for getting from Valdez to market, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff, which is the largest piece of the netback costs, any feeder pipeline tariffs to get oil from the field to the pump station 1 of the pipeline, Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and then also any adjustments for quality bank. If the oil coming out of a specific field is a higher or lower quality than average, there's an adjustment mechanism there. And so after subtracting all of those transportation costs, which, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, added up to about $1.5 billion in our fiscal year 21 forecast, we arrive at a total gross value at point of production for tax purposes of about $7.8 billion for fiscal 21.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And can you tell us the direction that the $9.78 per barrel has been going in the last decade?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, generally the direction has been up. Transportation costs have increased over the last decade. That's a function of general inflation as well as lower production. There's a lot of fixed costs of operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and pipelines generally, and as production goes down, you're spreading those costs over a lower number of barrels, and so the per barrel transportation charge goes up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickel, does that mean that some of the ships that are leaving Valdez are leaving without a full load or not at capacity?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I believe the shippers are optimizing the marine shipping.
So the answer is yes. Possibly yes.
Possibly, I'm not
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can follow up on the...
I think you'll find there's less shipments. The ships are full. It's like the pipeline isn't half empty. The pipeline is full. It just runs slower.
Right. That would be an accurate statement. So with the Trans-Alaska pipeline, you have a fixed capacity and a fixed cost that you're spreading over the number of barrels. With the marine transportation, there are some fixed costs, but some variable. You can choose how many runs to make from Valdez to the West Coast.
Go ahead and continue.
So moving on to slide 11, now that we've calculated the gross value of the oil, our production tax in Alaska is essentially a modified net profits tax. So we use IRS guidelines in general to define capital expenditures, which are deductible in the production tax calculation. One important aspect of our production tax system is that we allow immediate deduction of all capital costs in the year incurred. There is no requirement to depreciate those capital costs. And then for operating expenditures, these are any allowable expenditures that are not a capital expenditure, is how it's defined in statute. Essentially, this is the operating expenditures or the ongoing labor and operations costs. So there's two terms to point out as we're getting into lease expenditures. One is allowable lease expenditures, and the other is deductible lease expenditures. So allowable lease expenditures are generally any cost in the unit that's directly associated with producing the oil. Not everything is an allowable lease expenditure, so there are costs that companies incur that fall outside of our tax guidelines, and we don't track those costs, but it's important to note that they do exist. Some examples of non-allowable costs in the production tax code include financing costs, lease acquisition costs, dispute resolution costs, dismantlement, and restoration costs at the end of production. And then deductible lease expenditures, which is what we show here in the income statement, that's a term of art that we use for presentation purposes and communication. It's not defined in any statute. When we say deductible lease expenditures, we're referring to that portion of allowable lease expenditures that are applied in the tax calculation in the year incurred. And so this gives you a measure of what the tax impact of the lease expenditures was in a given year. Any lease expenditures that are considered non-deductible, those are any allowable lease expenditures that exceed the gross value at point of production. So if a company is spending or investing more than they're taking in revenue, those additional lease expenditures would be considered non-deductible, and those actually turn into a carried forward lease expenditure that we show at the bottom of the slide here. So for instance, for fiscal year 2021, we're forecasting about $4.6 billion in deductible lease expenditures, which get applied in the tax calculation. And then we're forecasting an additional $1.3 billion of lease expenditures that are carried forward and potentially could be used to offset taxes in a future year.
Okay, we have a question from Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, if you think about this, I'd be interested in seeing what's allowed and what isn't allowed under the expenditures, under the deductibles, if they have a chart of...
I don't know if they have that prepared with us today, but it's...
Not today, but if it...
But we can have them get back to you. It's listed out in the statute book. Some of those, as I recall, would have been excluded anyway. We listed them for clarity, I guess, years ago when we went to a production sharing tax. Mr. Stickles, correct. The guidance was to use the IRS guidelines because there's multiple decades of litigation that has clarified what the deductions, capital, and operating are. But we'll have the department come back with to the committee members of a kind of a breakdown on the operating and capital expenditure portion of the statute book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I just want to kind of comment on the $1.3 billion at the very bottom. And then you mentioned just now that the carry forward you expect for this year is about another $4 billion or so. Is that because there's been a tremendous amount of investment in the North Slope in the last year?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, to clarify, we are forecasting that about $4.6 billion of lease expenditures are applied against the tax calculation in fiscal year 2021, and then an additional $1.3 billion would be carried forward to the future.
Okay.
And that is, that overall lease expenditures forecast is a significant increase from what we've seen the last few years. We are expecting significant additional investments as new fields come online.
And just to help clarify that, can you explain a little bit why they can't deduct that $1.3 billion, you know, when you're starting a new expansion or a new field or what have you?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the production tax value, which I believe we get into a little bit more on the next slide, the production tax value is essentially the net income of the company. And so you take your gross value, which is your revenue, you subtract lease expenditures, which are your costs, to get to your production tax value. But the production tax value cannot go below zero. So you are able to deduct costs up to your revenue, and then any additional costs you can carry forward. And so the reason that we have the $1.3 billion potentially being carried forward is that a lot of the costs being incurred to develop new fields are from tax, potentially new developers, new taxpayers. So if a company is going out and spending billions of dollars to develop a major new asset that will lead to future production in the state, they don't have enough revenue to apply those in the current year.
Follow up?
So thank you, I appreciate that. What I want to sort of describe is, put it in more of layman terms, if there is a person who buys a building and they do a significant renovation on it, fix it up, and buy new furniture and fixtures, that will be a big cost over the course of, let's say, a year. They are able to then amortize those leasehold improvements and the furniture and fixtures over time through an amortization schedule. So it's not, what you're talking about here is not anything unlike what I just described as well. It is a normal course of business to encourage investors to come and make improvements on assets. It is my explanation apples to apples?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, that's a good example. You know, one of the differences is that in Alaska we allow immediate expensing of all of those capital expenditures. So maybe in the building example, it would be like if you came in and renovated that building before you had any renters, you'd incur a lot of expenses and you'd have no revenue to offset that. And we'd allow you to take that renovation expense and apply it against revenue in the future years when you have renters in that building.
And just for those watching at home, this is not unique to Alaska. This is how the industry is handled worldwide. You have to allow the deduction of expenditures. The question is the timing of when, and it significant, as we'll see in future hearings, it significantly changes the economics. So you cannot exclude the industry from deducting their costs, because you'll turn their economics completely upside down. The challenge that the sovereigns have is the timing of the deductions against the future revenue, because you always want to have some revenue into the sovereign. And that is normally restricted at some level of deductibility against that current year. But you cannot block the industry from deducting these expenditures, or the economics just wouldn't work in any field on the planet. Senator Wilkowski.
What sort of deductions do Texas, North Dakota, Louisiana, California, Wyoming allow for their oil and gas operations from their gross tax and royalty structures.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm not prepared to speak to those other tax regimes today.
I think the answer is zero, right? Their gross tax structures, their gross royalty structures.
Could you speak up a little bit? I can't have trouble hearing you.
That I think the answer is zero because they have a gross tax and royalty structures. Is that fair to say?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I believe we have addressed this in a prior year, and I believe there is some nuance around that statement, and we'd be happy to provide that.
So we'll take that subject matter when we have our consultants here. We're going to have our consultants here in several weeks, and we can go over some comparisons. The state of Alaska is unique in the United States. We're the only state that owns a subsurface. All the other states, the vast majority of the subsurface is owned by the privately by the farmers or the ranchers, what have you. Alberta is structured somewhat similar to Alaska, where the sovereign in Alberta owns the subsurface. So we are definitely different. So you won't find these severance tax structure in any other state in the union. So, but we'll go through those comparisons, Senator Wilkowski, on the North Dakota, the Permian Basin, I think is two that come up quite often, North Dakota shale and the Permian Basin down in Texas and over into New Mexico on the shale. So we can bring that comparison back later, but it's really not the Department of Revenue's background to do the comparison, but we'll have it done. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then on lease expenditures, just looking at the fall revenue sources book, it looks like in 2014, the first year that Senate Bill 21 was in effect, you had $7,839,000 in total statewide lease expenditures. And then in 2020, that number's down by $2 billion to $5.8 billion. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, if it came from our revenue sources book, that's our best understanding. But again, today, our goal with this presentation today is to focus on the nuts and bolts of how the system works, not to get into
specific policy
in comparison to other jurisdictions.
Right, so we're going to try to keep it on track. This is the kind of the basics of the operations preceding the future presentations that will go into some more of the detail, but, you know, they're not I didn't ask them to prepare a presentation on historical comparisons other than back a couple of years and going forward a couple of years. But we can take a look at that in future hearings as far as the historical comparisons back to the inception of the production sharing tax, if the committee would like. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk about the trends of the capital investments?
Sure, Senator Wilson, through the chair. So we saw capital expenditures dropped off quite a bit with the oil price crash that we saw a few years ago. And capital expenditures actually bottomed out for the North Slope at about $1.7 billion in fiscal year 2018. As oil price has recovered a little bit, and as some very significant new developments have been identified, capital expenditures increased last year in fiscal year 19 for the first time in several years, and we are expecting multiple years of significant increases going forward.
So we want to try to keep them on track. I'd say, you know, if they're, we can come back to questions that are, you know, I guess, on the side of the presentation. We don't want to get through the presentation today, so we've got the background to get into the future subject matters. Go ahead and continue.
All right. So to recap, Mr. Chairman, slide 11 talked about lease expenditures and how some lease expenditures are deductible in the production tax calculation, and then any lease expenditures in excess of that can be carried forward to be used in future years. Moving on to slide 12, this is where we calculate production tax value, frequently called PTV. The production tax value is the gross value less any deductible lease expenditures. Essentially, this is similar in concept to the net profit on the slope. So each company will calculate its production tax value based on all of their North Slope activity, including all fields that are currently producing and any investments in new developments. So every company has a different production tax value calculation. This is essentially the tax base for the production tax as a net profits tax. And so on slide 13, there are two parallel tax calculations that we look at, and we show these side by slide. There's a net profits tax based on production tax value, and then there's a gross tax floor, and the final tax is the higher of those two calculations. The gross tax floor is 4% of gross value at oil prices exceeding $25 per barrel, which hopefully will be the case as far as we can see going forward. So for fiscal year 2021, the minimum tax is that 4% times the gross value of $7.8 billion, or about $312 million is the gross tax floor calculation for fiscal 2021.
And I think, Stickle, it's important to note that the starting points are different on the two tax for those following along, the minimum tax versus the net tax.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So the minimum tax is based on the gross value of the oil, and then the net tax is based on the net value of the oil. Slide 14 is a new slide that we added this year, just to give some background on gross value reduction before we start talking about it in more detail. So gross value reduction is an incentive for new development. It was part of the Senate Bill 21 tax reform that was passed in 2013. It provides a temporary benefit to new oil from qualifying new fields. The gross value reduction allows a company to exclude 20 or 30% of the gross value for qualifying fields from the production tax value calculation, which reduces the net tax calculation for those fields. It does not reduce the gross tax calculation. The gross value reduction, you'll also hear it called the GVR, which is the acronym there. This expires after 7 years of production or after any 3 years of production with oil prices greater than $70 per barrel. So for GVR eligible production, there's also a flat $5 per barrel tax credit in lieu of the sliding scale credit, and we'll get into that in coming slides.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, in this GVR, was it adjusted in 2016 or 2017? I can't remember. In 247 or House Bill 111.
We can have your guy check that and jump back in and answer that question if you want. Okay, go ahead and continue. And then when he has the answer, he can just pass it to you and we'll get it in the meeting. I want to keep going here because we're going to run out of time. So go ahead and continue.
Sure. Moving on to slide 15 then, and we can also get back to the committee on the changes that happened to the GVR calculation. So the net profits tax is based on production tax value times the 35% tax rate. And the GVR reduction is shown here for those companies that have a positive production tax value. So you get the production tax value less the gross value reduction amount to get to your net production tax value for tax purposes of about $3.1 billion. And then the 35% net tax rate applies to that number to arrive at about $1.1 billion, which is the net tax before application of credits for fiscal year 2021.
Okay.
have a note here that the GVR sunset was added in House Bill 247 in 2016, okay, which would be the answer to the previous question.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So moving on to slide 16, this is where we look at the tax credits that are applied in the tax calculation. The primary tax credit available for oil production is the per taxable barrel credits. The per taxable barrel credits include a flat $5 per barrel credit available for gross value reduction eligible production and a sliding scale credit for the non-gross value reduction production. You'll also hear these credits referred to as the 024I and 024J credits. That's the statutory reference to the part of the production tax statute which contains the language for those credits. So the vast majority of the credit is for the sliding scale credit for non-gross value reduction eligible production. That is something that could change as we bring on significant new developments in future years. But for the non-GVR production, the credit rate ranges from the credit is zero when wellhead or gross value per barrel is greater than $150 per barrel, and the sliding scale credit is $8 per barrel when the gross value is less than $80 per barrel, which is the case presently. The non-GVR sliding scale credit cannot be used to reduce the tax below the minimum floor. And any companies claiming the sliding scale credit cannot reduce their tax below the minimum floor using other credits. For GVR eligible production, again, they get a flat $5 per barrel per taxable barrel credit for that production. That credit can be used to reduce the minimum, to go below the minimum tax floor if the companies choose not to use any of the sliding scale credits.
Question, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You probably don't have it off the top of your head, but could I get the per barrel, the aggregated per barrel credits that are provided at each of the legacy fields, and also the aggregated lease expenditures at each of the legacy fields, Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and Alpine?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, there are confidentiality provisions.
Aggregate. I said aggregate.
We will provide it in the level of detail that we are able to.
Thank you.
I think it's highly unlikely that we can have that broken down, including parsing out Point Thompson. We've struggled with that here with the confidentiality issue for years in different magnitudes of net value and costs and tariffs, and then having everything aggregated back into basically the revenue source book for us to create policy on. So if you could have any clarity on any of that stuff that you could give us, we'll welcome it. But we've asked that question many, many times. Go ahead and continue.
We'll take a look, Mr. Chairman, and provide whatever level of detail we're able to do. So the per taxable barrel credits are the two largest tax credits applied in the tax calculation. There are a small amount of other tax credits against liability. These include primarily small producer credits. And so after subtracting the various credits in fiscal year 2021, we're estimating a total production tax after credits of about $305 million. Slide 17 looks at some other items that get added to the total production tax revenue received by the state in any given year. So these are things like any prior year tax payments or refunds, private landowner royalty tax, the hazardous release surcharge, any tax on gas production, and any Cook Inlet tax liabilities. So added up, all of those other items added up to about $23 million. And the $328.1 million at the very bottom there represents the total cash expected to the general fund from production tax in fiscal year 2021.
And that question was asked to them when they put the presentation together to make sure they net everything out so we can see the net, because there's always the discussion of the statutory tax rate versus the effective tax rate, statutory being 35% before the per barrel deduction, and then the effective rate, which is pretty close to 10% of 328 million against, or 304 million, pick your number, doesn't really matter, against the 3.2 billion. So roughly 10% in that range, I think we've been in for several years. Go ahead and continue.
So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the basic walkthrough of the production tax income statement. What we have on slide 18 is the same analysis from the previous slide, but looking at a five-year spread. So we have 2 years of history, the current year, fiscal year 2020, and then 2 years of forecast. And so in fiscal year 2018 and fiscal year 2019, we actually had some major taxpayers paying above the minimum tax floor, and you ended up with about $750 million in production tax revenue in fiscal 18 and a little under $600 million in fiscal year 19. Generally, for the current year, fiscal year 20, as well as 21 and 22, we expect companies to be able to generally use sliding scale credits to bring their tax liability down to the minimum tax floor.
Are you done with that slide?
I think so, Mr.
I think to get back to Senator Wilikowski's question, he's asking some for a little more retrospective look in history. So if I could get you to maybe take the same data set and start with maybe 2010 and continue the table back to 2010 for the committee, that should give Senator Wilikowski a base for his question to then be reformatted and delivered to our consultants for discussion. Or revenue and DNR in future meetings. But if you could do that, that would be helpful.
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
Does that help, Senator Wilikowski, with the historic data?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So looking at 2018 and 19, you stated that the total tax paid to the state was above the minimum tax floor, and that for the forecast of 21 and 22 should be at the minimum tax or so. Could you explain why?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. So the primary driving factor there is the change in price, as well as the change in company investment. And so if you have a higher price and lower spending, you'll have a higher production tax value, and the net tax can exceed the gross tax floor in that case. What we've seen is in the present year, prices are a little bit lower than they were in fiscal year 18 and 19, and company spending has increased, so the production tax value is a little bit lower than it was in the prior 2 years.
And I think we're pretty close to that tipping point, are we not?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. The tipping point, and we had a slide in a previous presentation to the committee that we can provide again if you'd like. That tipping point is around the $80 a barrel range in the current fiscal year.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I also, just looking at 2020, looks like there's $11.4 billion of oil going down the pipeline. We're getting $380 million in taxes. That's a tax rate of less than 4%. The royalties, $1.4 billion, that's around 11.5%. So we're getting a gross of around, the total value of our oil of around 15 or 16%. And I'd be curious how that compares throughout history. My understanding is that's the lowest that we've gotten in the history of the state. Gross royalties and taxes. So I'd be curious how that compares with the historical values we've received since statehood. And then secondly, if you were to overlap, because we were told we needed to cut our taxes to be more like Texas and North Dakota, and my understanding of Texas and North Dakota is the average royalty rate's 25%, the average tax rate's 10%, that's 35% gross. We're getting less than half of what they would have to pay in Texas and North Dakota. So I'd be curious to see a Texas-North Dakota analysis as well on how much they'd be paying on $11.4 billion of oil.
Do you think that's coming attractions in future presentations with our consultants? There is some historical data that goes back to statehood. That might be, we'll have to talk about that request, but let's maybe back it up at least 10 years or to 2010 and kind of build it from there. And if you have some historical data that you can get back to the committee on since statehood, I think a lot of that is in the source books over time. So if you could put something together to, you know, help with that question. And other, and again, the comparative analysis of basins get a lot more complex than what we're talking about here today, but we'll have that coming, I'm sure, over the next several weeks as a refresher. Because any other questions on this slide? Any other additions that the committee members may want? Does 2010 seem like a reasonable starting point? Okay, we'll do 2010. Speeding along here.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, so that concludes the basic presentation. And I understand we have a hard out in about 25 minutes.
I'll watch the clock. You just flow the information to us. I'll speed you up if we're running them, counting the slides down. So.
Sure. So now I'd like to have Connor go through some of the information in the addendum.
Okay, Mr. Bell. I want you to enlighten the Finance Committee and all the details that are coming. So take it away.
And for the record, this is Connor Bell, and I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. All right, so the first slide is we're frequently asked to show an analysis of the distribution of cash flows, what's also referred to as government take. And so it's taking the share of net cash flows after deducting the transportation costs and lease expenditures. So it's similar to what we were just talking about with the production tax value. So it's essentially looking at that production tax value and then looking at how much of that goes to producers versus state and municipalities versus the federal government. And we're modeling this two ways. First off, to try and get at a typical legacy non-GVR producing field in Alaska to see what their economics are like. And then we're then taking into account, in the other example, all North Slope production and spending to get a sense of, across the North Slope, what the take looks like.
Okay, and then again, before we jump in with a bunch of questions, as we go through this, this is, again, trying to lay the foundation down for further hearings or information the committee may request, but there's been so much different information out in public, I thought it would be nice if we clarified where Alaska is, and then we can have some discussions possibly of where other basins are or where we may want to be or not want to be. But first we got to figure out where we're at. So that's kind of what this discussion is. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, so next slide, slide 22. We're taking the example of a typical non-GVR producing field, and this just lists out some of the assumptions for that modeling. And this is a standard analysis we've been presenting for several years. We're taking FY 2021 data and assuming that forecast price of $59 per barrel, and we're assuming a single company with only non-GVR production, and we are taking all of the forecasted statewide production of 490,500 barrels per day, but we're only applying deductible CapEx and OpEx, which again is spending that can be applied against a production tax liability. Next slide. Slide 23, based on those assumptions, this is what the government take looks like. And so at the bottom, you can see the lease expenditures and property tax taken out. And the remainder is what's split up amongst everyone. And so that's about half of the total value. And so state and municipalities get about 41% of that. the federal government, the state and municipality, that includes royalties and all property taxes, the federal government gets about 12% based on that 21% marginal corporate tax rate. And I should mention that since a few years ago, this has changed. So if you're looking at presentations from a few years ago, the federal take looks different because of that older top marginal tax rate of 35% for federal tax.
Okay, so you've taken into account the federal law change from 35 to 21
percent
on the statutory rate for C corporations. And have you done any modifications for the potential subchapter S new member to our oil basin that will have impact on that tax? Or how did you deal with that in the analysis?
I don't believe we took that into account, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so this analysis is based on all participants in the subchapter C or 21%.
Yes, and I think we'll speak to that in a few slides, okay, Mr. Chair.
Fine. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see this breakout done on the legacy fields with the aggregated information from Prudhoe Park and Alpine. Thank you.
If that's possible, if not, we'll ask our consultants. That question's been asked before, and we spent a lot of time here dealing with legacies and the newer fields. And for those watching at home, that's why we have the gross value reduction, is to try to help balance that, because there's significant profitability and cash flow differences. So we'll, if whatever information you can help the committee with on that.
Yeah, and again, Dan Stickle for the record, addressing Senator Wilikowski's point through the chair. This slide 23 looks at a typical barrel of production from non-GVR eligible fields and includes only deductible costs that are able to be applied against revenue in the tax calculations. So this slide 23 is intended to represent legacy field production.
Okay. With the 21% tax rate?
That's correct.
In FY 21 expenditures, correct? Okay.
Thank you. For the record, again, this is Connor Bell. And going on to slide 24, this is taking that same analysis and showing it at a range of ANS oil prices. And one that's apparent is that as you go to lower prices, the state and municipal take gets larger. And at $40, it says 100%, but the state take and municipal take is actually greater than 100% of those cash flows. And that's because some elements are fixed, such as property tax, and other elements are based on the gross value, like the royalties and the production tax at lower prices. And so the state gets its share to some extent regardless of lower prices.
So I know that's been a subject that we've struggled with over the years on clarity on low oil prices, how the fixed components, as you mentioned, impact the profitability of the oil and puts us at 100% take at low oil price. And we can have further explanation coming on that from our consultants also if we'd like. For clarity. And to Senator Wilikowski's question, I think the previous question about the legacy fields, we can have them parse the legacy fields versus non-legacy fields and then blend them together for the aggregate, I think would be helpful in future hearings, because we've done that before when we were looking at the issue back in 10, 11, and 12, when we were putting it in 13, when the GVR component actually surfaced as part of a solution. Good to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, moving on to slide 25. Now we're looking at our other analysis where we're taking into account all slope-wide production and costs. And so instead of just looking at deductible costs, we're looking at all upstream costs, and that includes exploration and development expenditures. And we're taking the same total production, but we're assuming 51,200 barrels a day of gross value reduction eligible production.
And just for clarity before we move on, so I understand, are you talking about using all even non-producing fields expenditures in this chart?
Yes, that's correct. And so this includes, say, fields that are not yet in production and are just incurring exploration and development costs.
Okay. We've never used that for sharing relationships, but it's interesting information.
Yes, it's a much different perspective, Mr. Chair, on how the cost, the share is split up. And as a result, the lease expenditures you can see are much larger and take up a bigger share and leave less cash flow to be distributed amongst the parties. And so of that remaining value, the state municipalities get about 57%. So similar to the previous slides, but just of a slightly smaller pie. The federal government gets about 9%, and this is from that that 21% federal tax rate, and producers get about 34%. And just to note, we did provide the analysis based on this previously, I think last year, to committee, and it's changed from what we did in our fall 18 forecast of FY 2020. And a major reason for that is because we expect significantly higher exploration and development expenditures in 2021. And those are from major expenditures on projects that will eventually we expect to advance production. That next slide, again, is just showing those that same analysis, but at a range of ANS oil prices. And the same point applies from before, that at lower oil prices, the state share gets larger and even exceeds 100% due to those fixed and gross value-based taxes.
Okay, just a second before you run off. So the difference between these two columns, subject to no state corporate income, or subject to state corporate income tax, again, this is all at 21%?
Yes, that is correct. We're assuming all 21%. And we're in the next slide, we actually get into assumptions about pass-throughs versus C corporations.
And these are, and the cost you use in this splitting of the net cash or profit oil, you're using all expenditures or just deductible expenditures?
Mr. Chair, we are using all expenditures here.
So you're adding the $1 billion or whatever it was back
a few
slides ago?
$1.3 billion, and yes, that is included. That $1.3 billion of those lease expenditures that would be carried forward because they were not deductible.
Okay.
All right, so we were also requested to put together an analysis looking at the impact to the state cash flows based on the type of corporation producing the oil. And so the barrel on the left is the same as what we showed you two slides back. It's assuming that all production is coming from a C corporation that is subject to state corporate income tax. And the barrel on the right is assuming a pass-through entity such as an S corporation or partnership is producing all of the oil in the state. And so essentially these are two extremes as an illustration. And you can see that the state municipal take in the right on the pass-through example is 54% versus 57% in the C corporation example. The federal take is higher in the S corp, or sorry, the pass-through example because of there's no state corporate income tax to be deducted against the federal tax liabilities, and the producer share is larger in the pass-through example at 37% versus 34% in the C-Corp example.
So if you could maybe restate these barrel graphs and add dollars to them also. You got percentages, but it'd be nice to see the dollars so we can reference back.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to provide that.
Including transportation, lease expenditure, property tax, I mean, each component of the barrel. I assume these are to replicate an oil barrel.
Sorry, I didn't catch that, Mr. Chair.
The column is to replicate an oil barrel, splitting of a barrel.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. All right. So slide 29 is looking at different assumptions for the sliding scale per taxable barrel credit. We were asked by the committee to show how revenue would be impacted by different levels. We are currently in the current law, as Dan discussed, we're at $8 per taxable barrel, and that applies up to wellhead prices of $80. And so in current and forecasted price ranges, we expect to remain at that $8 per taxable barrel. And note that these are hypothetical scenarios and don't relate to any actual proposals. So the left most columns represent the status quo, and then further right you see examples using changing that sliding scale non-GVR credit to be $5, $4, or $3 per taxable barrel. And one thing I should note is that not all per taxable barrel credits get used necessarily due to the minimum tax floor, because you can only apply them down to that floor. And in some cases, companies can use other credits to make up for a lower amount of that sliding scale credit. So for instance, you can't just compare the $5 and $4 per taxable barrel credit by taking that dollar change and multiplying it by the taxable production, because companies can compensate in some circumstances with other credits. So that would be exaggerating the impact. And
go ahead and continue.
Oh, these just to note that these scenarios assume that company behavior does not change as a result of any sort of tax changes. And obviously, those changes could impact investment and company behavior. And so the reducing the $5 taxable barrel credit in FY21 would reduce the, or increase the amount of tax paid to the state by from $328 million to about $414 million. The $4 per taxable barrel credit would bring in about $445 million, and the $3 credit would bring in about $531 million.
Okay, so we're going to need a breakdown on, well, I might as well just pick the $5, because there's about a $100,000 swing here that just disappears due to these other deductions that are coming against it versus changing the $8 per barrel slider to $5. That's a significant difference. So I need you to get back to the committee on the breakdown on that, so we can see what component parts are sliding in against the revenue, the per barrel, along with the per barrel calculation. I'd start with, you know, we have the base tax revenue of 35%. You might as well start with that number, make it easy, because that number's set. And then give us the breakdown under the eight, give us the breakdown under the five. We might as well do the three then too. There's not much, there's a sliding difference, but there's other things flowing, other expenditures and deductions flowing in against that. So we need to, I want to see what they actually are, so I have a better understanding of that. And then we'll get it out to the committee.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to provide that. Thanks.
And that's, again, part of the complexity of the tax structure we have when you move one lever, other levers are moving around, other things are moving around. So we'll clarify that. And if you could take it down by step, where you have the per barrel deduction, you know, if it's eight barrels, it's probably around $770 million. And then take it down and show us the deducts, the impact of the $5 per barrel that we're not changing on the GVR fields, and any other credit flows or calculations that are flowing against that. So we have a good understanding of the cogs on the wheel that make this thing move. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think also what might help is, I know that there's a graph in the, on page 86 of the revenue source book that shows the price forecast, the crossover point, and so forth. But what might be helpful, and I'll defer to the chair if he thinks this would be helpful, is to kind of put the per barrel credit kind of on a number line. So if you see, you know, $100, $90, $80, $70, and just where does the per barrel credit kind of affect, where does it go on the number line? You try to do that a little bit with this graph. But I know that sometimes it's the graph is not, it's not as clear. Does that make sense?
What we're asking for is the sensitivity for, on the per barrel credit?
Yes, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think where it falls, maybe a little bit more of a detailed of where the 8.7654 falls on the per barrel price.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the next slide may speak to your questions and let us know if you still have remaining questions.
Okay, we'll go to the next slide. And
So slide 30 is showing that those same scenarios from the prior slide and applying them to a range of ANS prices from $40 to $90 per barrel. The y-axis is production tax revenue in millions of dollars. So the status quo line represents our current tax system, and at about $89, you can see the uptick in slope in the blue line, and that's where in our current system the per taxable barrel credit goes from $8 to $7. And the other lines we're holding constant at $5, $4, and $3 per barrel. And I should also note that we're holding the GVR $5 per barrel credit flat at that level for all scenarios. And so you can see that the revenues are higher even at lower prices. And another aspect is that the crossover point where companies begin paying net taxes, those are occurring at lower oil prices in the scenario.
Does that help?
This is helpful because this is a type of sensitivity analysis, because you can see with the four different colors, i.e. the different tax per barrel, especially in the dotted line. Thank you for putting that in for today's price, that we can see, again, 100, 200, or less than 100, the differences. So thank you for that. I think, though, sometimes is it always $8, or is it 8888877766 over a larger period of time? Is it just 8? Does it drop off abruptly at $77? Does it drop off abruptly to $6 at $62? Do you see what I'm saying? I see your flow of your line. It works. I'll talk to my co-chair, and maybe we can get back to you.
Yes, I have a table I can show you.
Yeah, okay.
That might help clarify it, because it does get complicated. All the moving spokes and wheels and rubber bands to make this thing work. And then maybe we'll, on that sensitivity, if you could give us an idea on the moving costs. You know, we've got price per barrel. It makes a difference, and also the operating capital. Numbers moves that break-even point around, so the committee can kind of get an idea of, because a few meetings ago we were talking about the tipping point moving on up to maybe north of $100 a barrel. We'd be, you know, so we'd basically be in a minimum tax for the foreseeable future. Does that recall the testimony? Is that half correct there?
Senator Sidman, Dan Stickle for the record. I don't think it quite reaches $100 per barrel in our forecast. We do have a response to the committee working its way through the bureaucratic process that looks at the expected crossover point between gross and net tax over the next several years.
Yeah, because there's several moving components. Some have more impact than others, but yeah, when that's ready, you can package it up with the rest of the stuff you'll be sending us. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I get, if I could just get you to go back real quick to page 8, order of operations, because my numbers are coming out a little different than yours. You got $59 a barrel oil, and the royalty, the state gets $1.2 billion. My number comes out to $6.70 that we get for the royalty. The $9.78% tariff, that goes to back to the producers predominantly because they own the pipeline. They get their $29.02 back, which leaves a profit of $20. Of that, the state gets $1.83 roughly per barrel. I think what would be helpful is if you plugged in how much is going to the state and how much is going, the exact number per barrel. I'd be curious to see that. So, for example, royalty and federal barrels, plug in 1.2 billion divided by 10 billion, and you're going to get like $6.70 royalty roughly. And then if you could plug in for that whole per barrel, so we can see how much exactly is going to the state and how much exactly is going to the producer and the federal government. I think that'd be real helpful. Thank you.
You could help the committee on any of that clarity and putting some percentages on there, I guess, is what Senator Wilkowski is asking for.
Sure. If I understand the question, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, will provide this order of operations chart on a per barrel basis. No problem.
In fact, that's normally how they've done it in the past, and I've been encouraging them to put it in dollars because little pennies movement has significant changes. So we can have that done in percentages.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, I think we have a couple slides left in the addendum. We should be able to breeze through those pretty quick and get you guys out of here on time.
Again, this is Connor Bell for the record. On slide 31, we were asked by the chair to update our count the cash slide that we presented on January 23rd, and it's looking at state revenues from oil and gas, and for production tax, it attempts to get at a net-net by subtracting out other liabilities, one of those being credits purchased by the state, assuming statutory appropriation, and the other being lease expenditures earned and carried forward, assuming that they will eventually be applied at a 35% rate against future tax liabilities. And so that can only occur if those can only be applied down to the minimum tax floor, and they cannot be applied unless the spending occurred on a field that advances to production. And so not necessarily all of those credits, those carry forwards, will be applied against future liabilities. Interesting thing about this slide is you can see in FY 2021, the net production tax actually goes negative, although the total petroleum revenue to the state is a positive $1.2 billion.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. And in your previous slides, like slide 11, for example, you had non-deductible lease expenditures carry forward to $1.322 billion for 2021. And here you're showing lease expenditures earned and carried forward $462.8 million. Can you just explain that difference?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe that is applying the 35% tax value. So I believe that if you multiply those values in the earlier slides by 35%, you would reach the values in this table. And that's just trying to get at the real amount that can be deducted against future liabilities.
The reason I asked them to bring this these type of slides forward, and they're kind of the two of them, the next one's a little different too, is to try to get a feel for the net cash position and the potential impact on the net cash of credits when they come against the Treasury. And trying to keep our eye on the net cash flow.
Moving on to slide 32. So as I said before, not all lease expenditures carried forward are necessarily being used. Now we're taking the other goalposts and assuming that none of those carried forward lease expenditures are applied against future tax liabilities, and how that would, the net-net looks to the Treasury. And as you can see, the production tax net-net no longer goes negative in FY 2021.
But just remember on this slide, they may not come against the Treasury in 21, but they will come against the Treasury when production turns on, because they have to be able to deduct their expenditures or their economic scope side down. So don't misinterpret the slide thinking that, you know, where there's some nefarious move to block deductibility of expenditures in the industry, because that's not the issue at hand here. So just remember on this slide, you still have substantial carry forwards that are going to have to be taken into account in the cash flow eventually, whenever that day comes. We have one last slide, I guess. And we got a couple minutes, so we're on time, so don't worry.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the last slide, we actually provided this, I believe, to the committee on January 23rd, and we figured we'd share it again because we think it's a great resource. The basic takeaway is that not all oil is the same, and oil is taxed at different rates depending on where it occurs. And So for production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax, they apply regardless of ownership. The only exception where they do not apply is offshore 3 or more miles, which is a federal outer continental shelf. And as far as royalty rates, they vary based on ownership, and we're happy to walk through those, or we can just leave this here as a resource.
Okay. Any other final comments or questions? So we've got a bunch of data to come back to the committee, and I'll get with individual senators on their questions or the answers and try to get those sorted out so we're ready to go for the next time the subject matter comes before us and in more detail. Any other questions, concerns before we adjourn? I'd like to thank the Department of Revenue for coming forward today. Appreciate the presentation. Some of us find it very interesting and fascinating, and it's very critical to the state. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we're going to have an update on the retirement system for the state and the school system. I'll be looking at the returns and liabilities and cash flow requirements that are needed to fund that unfunded liability. More at 9, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is very interesting. I'm wondering, you mentioned the consultants coming before the committee. Do you have a time frame when that might happen? So,
No, other than a tight time frame, other than probably the first part of into March. We're going to have a discussion on the referendum here at the table, and the consultants will be in town. So we'll try to have some of these questions answered from the consultants. So I'll be into March, I would think. They're preparing the stuff as we speak, so, as far as I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We are adjourned.